My name is Ruth Schultz, and this is my first session on drama for worship in the church, or chancel drama, if you will. This area of chancel drama is a particularly exciting one to me, and is one that I have been interested in since I was in college, really. Back in 59, toured with the first Cross and Crown Company, which worked in the Midwest about that time for several years. And I toured with them during their first summer tour and then continued to work with them periodically over a period of about 4 years, acting and directing, although not full time with the company, because I went on and was studying and was involved in other things. But since then, that summer that I first worked with them, we toured in a five-state area in the Midwest with a play called Christ in the Concrete City, which is by Philip Turner, who is an Englishman. And during that time, we would go and from church to church, or auditorium to church to auditorium to auditorium, in a variety of ways. And it was very exciting because we were always confronting a different physical context to adapt our material to. And we would have audiences from the size of this gathering to, I think there were 6,000 in St. Louis in the fall when we went there. That was at Kiel Auditorium. It was incredible. But so there were many different challenges, and it was a very good experience for me as an actress, because it meant having to make very quick adjustments and all. Most of us in our individual congregations are real familiar with the context, and so that's what I'm going to talk about this afternoon, because I think the drama can be used in many different ways. When I was in high school, the youth group would put on a spring play, and often that would be the extent of it, other than perhaps a Christmas program that the Sunday school would be involved in. And Christ in the Concrete City was a play which was done in the place of a sermon. And from that has developed a great many varieties of ways of integrating drama into services. And but yet they don't seem to be very broadly used. And I think it's partly because people often are timid about whether or not they can do it without drama backgrounds and all. My hypothesis is that there is somebody in every congregation who, given a little bit of encouragement, can begin to engage the problem of integrating text and the people, the unique individuals that she has in the context and the setting that they have, he or she, and make a contribution to the service which will in some way illuminate the subject for the day, or the season of the year, or whatever, the lessons for the day. I am going to talk primarily about the use of drama derived from the pericopes for a given Sunday. By the pericopes, I mean the Old and New Testament and epistle lessons for the day. The psalm also is designated, it's different each day, and centers around a theme. And I'm not in any way suggesting that every Sunday, that every series of texts is grist for this for this kind of work. Not all texts lend themselves. And if you are not inspired by something which serves the text well, then it's better just to wait until you are. And yet I want to say that, and yet at the same time I want to say that it's a wonderful way for expressing many facets of the faith and many dimensions of worship. It's a way of exploring the meaning of texts, like few other things are. So many Bible studies are set up pretty much with a presenter who's done the research, and then people who sit with their Bibles in front of them, and everybody kind of sits and does it. However, a Bible study which is designed for exploration of texts through drama can be dynamite as far as expanding the insights into it. It's one thing to sit and listen to a story being told about someone being carried by their friends to be healed by Jesus at a place. It's quite another to be a part of the crowd that's trying, cramming into this building to hear Jesus and trying to get people off their feet and off their backs so that they can hear Jesus, and then to be interrupted by this somebody tearing apart the ceiling and lowering and having to back off and make room for this imposer into the midst and interrupting the sermon or the what's going on, and experience what it is to go with all of this hope and expectation and effort and the tension of trying to keep everybody else quiet enough and away enough so that you can hear, and be interrupted and have Jesus convert the whole thing to a focus on this person who is imposed on us all, and to do the marvelous thing of healing them. And if you take part in a Bible study where you're one of the people in that crowd even, and go undergo the experience, then you discover something of the magnitude of the healing, which you can just read over in the Bible because it's so familiar, and because you think you know it all once you've heard that the man got there and he was in fact healed. You discover things about how God breaks through our frustrations and our angers and our efforts to get to him in one way, and breaks through to us in a whole another way we didn't expect, and it's so much more marvelous. And so I want to recommend it as a resource for Bible study. If you have the opportunity to work with either a class or of young people or children or adults, and that's the other thing, that it's a means of addressing and engaging all ages in the church. It's not just for the young people, as it was in my teens when I was in school. And finally, a drama in the church can be used and is always a form of celebration. And it fits, it belongs in the worship experience to me because it is celebrative, and that's part of what we're doing on a Sunday morning. It's a big part of what we're doing. And so it can contribute in all of those ways, as expression, as exploration, and as celebration. As far as the resources are concerned, there are many. Most ministers get tons of mailings, right, about things which are available through publishing houses, and so there are lots of opportunities for you to get already scripted material if you contact your minister. However, I want to encourage you to trust yourselves in exploring material from the Bible. Not only because if you're serious about it and take it seriously as a kind of ministry that you can contribute, the resources that you have within your congregation are uniquely characteristic of your congregation. I mean, here in the village, for instance, we have someone who can play a bagpipe. It's a marvelous thing. Well, most of us don't get to hear, unless we're Presbyterian, we don't ever get to hear bagpipes involved with worship. And yet bagpipes have a kind of a sound that nothing else does. It's kind of a wail. It's kind of, there's something very organic about it. The fact of it coming from the breath of the player through the instrument, which is the lung of an animal, and out through the wood reeds into the open air, it gives it a whole kind of travel which is very special. And I think that there are places where you can use that. If you have someone with bagpipes in your congregation, explore it. Look for chances to use them. You may have people who are trained singers or trained dancers. We have people who are gymnasts, or someone who is a mime or who can juggle, you've probably maybe seen juggling involved in services. All of these are ways of praising and of ways of expressing a dimension of human life which are unique to your congregation then. And so it's something to make use of and to keep track of. I encourage the use of the kind of identification tool when people come into the church, of not only getting their names and addresses and the names of their kids, but and their addresses, but also what sort of interests do you have? What kind of talents do you have? What do you like to do? And if someone who is interested in drama has that kind of a resource available to them, it may be buried information. The pastor may not even have it at his fingertips. But if you can spend a little time going through a file like that, you can identify resources among the congregation that are out there waiting to be asked. You know, too shy to put themselves forward, but if they were asked, they would be thrilled at having the opportunity to share what they have cultivated for themselves through to the congregation through worship in some way. And I found that time and time again. People who think they have nothing to contribute, and then all of a sudden a door opens for them and they become involved in, for the first time often, and discover their way as active members through that. So I want to encourage you to trust your own material, not only the material in the Bible, the material involved in the Sunday lessons, but the material that you bring yourself and the material that sits among you in the pews on Sunday morning. Now, I would like to look at a number of the elements that you need to think of, assuming that you're all going to do that. First of all is the setting. The setting is the church ordinarily, unless you're in a first unit school auditorium or classroom or storefront or whatever. And churches are, as a rule, pretty awful places to see a presentation of any kind, right? If you're beyond the second row, it's hopeless. And if you're a person who is older and who is hard of hearing or has difficulty seeing, the frustration can be enormous. And so you really want to keep that in mind and be careful that what you do isn't done down here on the level in front, where most of the people are going to miss it any more than is absolutely necessary. So you want to think about what are the best places for being seen and heard. I'd like you just to think for a moment about your own church where you live. Where are the best places to be seen and heard in your church? Let's just hear some of them.
The pulpit.
The pulpit, right. Why is that?
It's above.
It's higher, right. It's isolated.
What do you call it, a shell or something that will kind of radiate the sound of that?
Yes, especially in older churches there is, and also there's often amplification, so that that place is, it's expected that people will speak from there, and it's equipped for that in some way. Where else?
Well, up by the altar.
Up by the altar. The altar is usually raised in some way, as it is here. Huh?
You can't see, but our balcony is wonderful singing for instruments to be playing.
Aha!
Uh-huh. Sometimes singing, but it seems like people like to see the choir down below, but they've done some adjusting things from the balcony.
Uh-huh. Right, the balcony can create a nice change in level as well as in distance. And so you can get a kind of a calling back and forth, which is can be very nice.
In fact, once we did that with a program from the balcony and from the side aisles to the altar area.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, that's
a sense of distance and calling.
Right. That's another place where that is more accessible to people, the aisles. This, if you can have something which happens in various places along the aisles, then you have gotten closer to some of the people that are four and five rows back than if you're up in front. Okay, so we have the chancel, we have the pulpit and the lectern, balconies. In this place, the balcony is, you know, great because you can get all around the congregation, so there are lots of possibilities. You can even use the outside exit over here for coming in if you can make that fit in other ways. So all those are good places for being seen and heard. So you want to put the people that are speaking and moving in places where they are going to be seen and heard as much as possible. Ways that you can do something with entrances, with people speaking loudly before they get into a place. But if you're going to expect the people to understand what's being done, they have to be able to see it and hear it. Something else you want to think about are the levels. Churches vary a great deal, and like in here we have the balcony is one level, we have the floor level, which is everyone is condemned to this level pretty much, except for the pastors who are on this platform or on that level at the pulpit, and that's often the case. Churches will often have a series of levels all the way across the front, so that you will have a choice maybe of two or three steps and then a large flat area and then maybe three or four more steps up to an altar, which gives you a number of levels. And if you can use as much of that space as possible, depending upon what you're doing, then all of that becomes available to you. What else? The levels and little used areas. For instance, some churches will have a little alcove off to the side, which is very difficult to be seen and heard from, but if it can be amplified, it might be heard, and if whoever moves there moves through the congregation to get there, then it may be clearer. Or if there is a procession of some kind of people in the congregation past that place, that can be used. And when you're thinking about your setting, you also want to think about where are the entrances? Entrances are really unpredictable in churches, as you know. You often have a chancel, this kind of a traditional shape with the steps across here and the steps around here. You'll often have doors here and here and here and here and here and here, here and here and here and here and here and here. And so you've got all of these possible ways into the church or out of the church. And when you're thinking about using people to dramatize or to in some way clarify the lesson, and you want to think about where these voices come from, it makes sense to explore these entrances so that, let's say that the angel of God is coming. Okay, it might be real obvious just to have that person come from closer to the altar. The people of Israel who are far off probably come from out here in the narthex, because that is farther off, and as they move closer to the Lord, they can move here, which will increase the sense in the congregation, which is facing forward, of the people moving closer, and finally then they may respond, yes, we are the Lord's people. By that time, then they're down in here. Someone who is between the people of Israel and the Lord, like Moses, he might come out down there. And so you're using a sort of a logical and automatic, it's an automatic use of the structure to serve the meaning of what it is that you're doing, to identify who these people are. It's basically applying the technique that casting directors for commercials use. They find the people that look the most cliche type of person they can find to represent in a commercial, because it takes care of everything at one time. They aren't looking for unusual types particularly. They don't want people that have unique looks, but people that look like everybody else as much as possible, because it does all that. Well, when you use the area that way, you're doing the same thing. It right away tells people, oh, this is a voice of a messenger of God, or these people are further from God, they're coming in or they're going out or whatever. Okay, so that's, when you're looking at the setting, that's the first thing to be aware of and to spend some time thinking about, because that'll be with you as long as you're working in that place. Also, I would like just at this point to make a brief comment about entrances, and this mainly could come later, but I want to say it here. Because when you're working with people, it's very important that they understand that the nature of their entrance establishes also what we were just talking about who they are. And so when they come in as that representing that voice or that person, they need to make that entrance in that way, so that if it's the angel of the Lord and he comes in like this, and then it comes time for him to speak, and then he stands up like this, you want to communicate to that from the entrance, from the moment before they enter, they are the angel of the Lord and they're moving out to with this message. They have a work that they must are sent to do. So that's just a side thing about entrances. Okay, then after you look at the setting, you want to look at the context. The context for religious, for drama, chancel drama, in this case is the worship service. And so that's the primary thing why these people, why the people in this particular organization have come together at this particular time. It's to worship. And so there are a number of things that you want to keep in mind with that. First of all, you want to be sure that what you do is appropriate for worship. There are some things that are just not appropriate. And if you do them, then you're abusing the purpose of the gathering and the people that are, it's that you're ignoring something which is important about that. And it doesn't make any sense to do that. And so you want to be sure that what you are doing is worshipful. And it doesn't mean that it has to be sober or grim at all. It simply means that the intention that you go at it needs to keep that in mind, that the people that are here are worshipers in this situation. Since it's a part of a worship service, you also want to keep in mind that the length of time that you take to do it is a real factor. Most people come to church for an hour, and if we get into the I want to say commercials, it's not that, the announcements, and the announcements begin to include a letter from somebody and a poem by somebody else and a lengthy description of the vacation that someone just got back from, and people are going to feel used, and because they're thinking the roast is going to burn if they do that anymore, or they're thinking, oh, I've got to meet so-and-so by 2 o'clock and I've got to change and get over there, it's going to take me 45 minutes on the road and when's this going to end, and it's distracting. And so it isn't helpful to the worshipers if you get if you take much more time than a part of the service that you're going to be working within ordinarily takes. So it behooves you to keep what you're doing to the usual and expected amount of time. If there is an exception to that, and there can be exceptions to that, can be very useful. But my point is that if you're going to make an exception to that, if you have in fact a treatment of the Old Testament lesson that is so fantastic that the pastor says, "Oh, look, you can have my 20 minutes for the sermon." And he okays what you're doing and he accommodates you by not preaching the sermon then you're still staying within that frame, and people can relax in that assurance that you're not going to be doing something unexpected to them and spoiling the rest of their day. But that does need to be worked out ahead of time. And everything that I say is done on the assumption that indeed everything that that it, all the drama that's used will be done in coordination with the pastor, so that, I mean, you can't do these things in a void. And his theme for the day, you have to be sure that what you're going to do is going to serve the whole service. And so if you make that kind of an arrangement, you can do something longer. But that has to be planned beforehand. Yeah. Then, because the context is a worship context, you want to go for all the simplicity that you can. That means that you don't want to do something that's going to take a lot of time to set up and to strike when it's over. You don't want to have to haul off a stable before the service can continue, right? And you don't want to, you want the moving in and out of your contribution to be a natural flow with the rest of the service. If the people are going to be in the congregation, they can simply return to their seats when it's over and become worshipers like everyone else. Well, they're worshipers while they're performers too, but you need to be mindful of keeping it simple for your sake. Well, it's, the benefits are obvious. It requires a lot less preparation if you don't have to make sets and costumes and things. That's, not, again, not to say that you can't be big and elaborate, but that if you choose to be big and elaborate, be sure that it's serving the occasion and that it's accommodated for in the rest of what goes on. Then, thirdly, we think about the participants. I've touched on this already, but I want to just mention it again, because they can be from all age groups. As the leader of it, you need to let them communicate that they should expect to rehearse. Because, as I said with the reading of the lessons, what's happening is important and it deserves some care and attention. And the degree to which we give it that communicates the degree to which we take it seriously and think that it is important. If it's done sloppily, that's what it says. The participants must be willing to share. Willing to share their time, which goes toward the preparation. It doesn't have to be a lot of time, but it needs to be some time so that everyone knows what everyone's doing. They have to be willing to share their voices with meaning and clarity. They have to be willing to engage their bodies in the task that's required for that sharing. And so you may often find participants who are willing in spirit. And I'm not, and I think that you can, you know, certainly you want to work with those people, because if they're willing in spirit, then chances are their minds and bodies are going, and their voices will free up also once they gain some confidence in it. But they need to understand that it is a kind of sharing, and that if they're willing to do that, the rest will come. Not only to be willing to share their voices and their time and their bodies, but they must be willing to focus. When they're participating in drama in the chancel, they're not first of all performers, they're first of all worshipers like everyone else. And they should understand that while they move and speak, they're not doing it for their own glory, but to share and unite the doers and the viewers in a common experience, because participation is service. And that means that if the person that is addressing them is here and they're listening, that they can't do this. But they have to keep that focus, because the people watching them will be hearing what that person says, because you're channeling that energy which is coming towards you to that person. And so they then are experiencing it as you are, if they're watching you at that moment. Chances are they're watching the person who's speaking, but if they're not, you're feeding them back there again always. It's part of the same, it's the same dynamic that's at work when we go to a performance of dance. In a very real way, the dancer who's on stage dances for us all. The dancer does for us what our spirits would do, what if our bodies could, you know, that our bodies would do if they could do what our spirits wanted them to do. And they satisfy a need which is aroused by the music or by inner life experiences which can't be expressed in other ways. The same thing is true with drama. And so the person who is watching you is listening to that person, that same dynamic. It's a wonderful gift. It's a wonderful gift that we can do that for one another.